On To The Point, we try to make sense of the policy debates and the political sideshows on the campaign trail.
You have this kind of asymmetrical warfare coming from a guy who's great at a soundbite, lousy at an answer.
So are you looking for your own billionaire?
Nope. No, I don't want my own billionaire. I'm going to raise the vast majority of the money.
Brace yourself, America, for what?
King Trump.
I'm Warren Olney. To The Point has you covered for the 2016 campaign. Find the To The Point podcast on KCRW's iTunes page.
From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, it's The Treatment. Welcome to The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It was probably 40 years ago this year that my guest, Richard Dreyfuss, sitting in front of me, was filming the movie that won him the Academy Award, The Goodbye Girl. We know him from so many things, and for his incredible take on activism and civil conversation in this country, it's an honor to have him sitting across from me. Richard, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
And
thank
it probably you. Was 40 years ago that you were shooting The Goodbye Girl, wasn't it?
77.
Yeah. You probably shot it in 76.
Yeah.
And before we can start talking about other things, one of the things I want to talk to you a little about in terms of your acting is that you have a feel for characters with a presentational sense, that they know how to offer themselves up. They almost belong on the stage. Elliot was an actor, but so many of the characters you played could have been actors. I think about, we can say Dudley Kravitz, who I know you're not a big fan of that performance, but or certainly a character in Inserts, or Mr. Holland. Some of these characters that you play, Bernie Madoff, are guys who almost we can see them backstage putting on their costume. Kurt, in American Graffiti.
That's
all these
funny.
Are guys.
I never thought of it like that. I always said to myself that I loved to play characters who were self-aware. And in Graffiti, George offered me one of two roles, the character I played and Charlie Martin Smith's geek character. And I picked mine. He said, why? I said, because he's self-aware. He's going to remember that night, and he knows that night that he'll remember it 40 years from now. And that scene where he walks down the aisle and tries to open up his locker, that we did that scene just to show that he was thinking about that night during that night.
Oh, man. But do you see what I mean about these tell me these people you play to be characters who are, and it's basically a step past self-awareness. They're almost self-dramatists to some extent. They have a sense of who and what they are. I mean, whose life is it anyway? You can, almost any of these guys that you played on stage or in movies are people who have a sense of, they understand grandeur in some way or another, and they know how to present themselves in a way that demands attention almost. I mean, we were talking about Arthur Miller before we sat down, and these are guys, almost all of whom, and we can say certainly about Bernie Madoff, who say in their one way or another, attention must be paid, aren't
right.
they?
Right.
They're all these guys.
And I worked at L.A. County Hospital for 2 years as a conscientious objector, and I was a file clerk, and that means you're invisible. You know, you deliver a stat chart to a doctor, he doesn't even see you. He just signs off. And I just could not accept that. And so I developed a reputation at the hospital, first as being the guy who read a book in the island of light, then darkness, then light, then darkness at night, because I was on the midnight shift. And then I became friends with nurses and doctors and residents, and we hung out. And I refused to be invisible. I've never accepted it, ever. And had I been a teacher or a rabbi or whatever, I would have been vivid.
But that vivid sense is something that it makes, in some way, as we're talking about this, it feels like it makes some of these characters some way almost all autobiographical. You bring some part of yourself to make these guys work, don't you?
Sure. I think, you know, I played Chaney, and my response was, there's a little bit of Chaney in all of us. And there is. I used to say to young actors, in every actor, there is Hitler and Jesus. And you've got to find the right Hitler and the right Jesus and bring it out and make it work for the character. And that's true.
But it's funny, you talk about experience working at that hospital, and I'm trying to think of a character you played who somehow receded, who didn't bring some sort of command of himself into that. I mean, I think about your couple of lines in The Graduate, or and you just, these are all characters who are in their way impact players. And I wonder if they're, as a kid, they're an actor you were conscious of watching who had that kind of impact and made you say, yeah, I like that.
Well, I knew, and I wrote it as my conscientious objector statement. I knew when I was a kid that inside my brain was a universe as big as the universe, and that there were parts of my brain that were as known and unknown as the universe itself. And there were corridors that I'd never gone down. And then when I finally went down those corridors, I found on the wall, Shakespeare was here. And I was always looking for the nobility of acting, you know, and I found it. And I found it in me. And what I said to the draft board was, I have this universe in me, and the offense of my being killed and my universe dying, I have to assume that everyone has the same thing, and I couldn't kill anybody who has it. And they bought it.
What was the response to that when you wrote that treatise about yourself and you gave it to them? What did they say to you? Do you
they
remember?
You know what they said?
What?
If we give you your classification, would you go to work immediately? And I said, are you giving me my classification? And they said, yeah, we like your paper. And my mother said that I made a sound that she's never heard before or since, because I was all set that this was going to be just the first movement of a long train that ended either in Canada or jail. And they just handed it to me.
Because interesting, it's almost like if you make the right argument, which is from talking to you a little bit before we sat down to do this, your whole life is built around that in some way, isn't it? If you make the right argument, people will listen. They will respond.
Right. Damn right. If you can articulate what you are thinking, and if you know the difference between nonsense and sense, if you know that common sense is not common, and you seek common sense and can articulate it, people will listen. They may not listen after you leave the room, which has been my curse.
How do you mean?
Because I can pump up an audience while I'm talking to them until they reach the ceiling. And then I leave the room and they all just deflate. And that's been my problem as a public speaker on civics, for instance, from the beginning. And I don't know how to find like-minded people who will stay with it, who will stay with this. Civics, reviving civics, is literally the cure for every problem we have. It's a 20-year endeavor. I have never met, well, I met one person, but never met anyone really who I could say, I can hand off this thing to you, or we could do this together.
I don't know, because hearing you say that and just thinking, again, going back to the characters you play for a moment, there's a sense of these characters almost not needing other people. I mean, there's a sense of self-containment about a lot of these characters. We're talking about that self-awareness and that sense of scale. And these people are almost in some way or another on missions. And do you feel like it's hard for you maybe to get people to join along in this mission? Do you think that's what it is?
I can only say this, that when I began to seek stardom, and I did.
But why did you seek stardom rather than wanting to be a working actor? Because you certainly could continually.
I wanted to make decisions. I wanted to control my life. I didn't want to be just told what to do. And I have a smart brain, and I'm a writer and a director and like that. And stardom is power. But if you go too high and you get into that world of the biggest stars, they never leave their home. They don't live among people. And that's who they are, and that's all they are. And so I sought a medium celebrity. I turned down the biggest shows because I didn't want to be among the elite. I wanted to be living among people on Broadway and going to the grocery store. And that's what I got. I had a medium celebrity, and women could walk up to me on the street, 80-year-old women from Lithuania, and they would say, thank you. And they don't say that to their divorce lawyers, their neurosurgeons, or their ministers. They say it to actors, because actors show them the face of humanity.
It's the truth. My guess who may be the only person in the history of the show to say the right Hitler would be Richard Dreyfuss.
I tried to play him for years and was thrown out of every office I ever made.
Okay, you have to tell me about this. You wanted to play Hitler.
Absolutely.
Because
he's a human. And the story of him coming out of hospital in 1919, becoming a government agent to spy on the Nazis and buying the theology is a story of a little man becoming a big man beyond his control, and it is one of the great stories of the 20th century. And Dorothy Thompson wrote a column in 1934, and the first words were, "It only took me 4 minutes to realize that Adolf Hitler was a terribly insignificant little man."
Wow, that almost sounds like the kind of thing Hitler says to his therapist, isn't it?
And I wanted to play him from 1919 until the putsch in 23.
As he's becoming Adolf Hitler, before he becomes Adolf Hitler.
Yeah.
I know, too, that you once wanted to play Woody Guthrie.
Yeah. Because my grandmother knew him.
Really?
She was Eugene Debs' private secretary.
Wow.
And she was a witness to the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire on the street. Yeah.
There is clearly in your family a real sense of history, and history is being passed down so these ideas and thoughts remain alive, isn't there?
There's a real Americanism in my family of political activism, and I got it in my infancy. I mean, my grandmother was Eugene Debs' private secretary. My mother caused legislation in World War II that got the soldiers the vote and got the Red Cross thrown out of the front lines because they were charging a nickel, a coffee, and they segregated blood.
Between soldiers of color and white soldiers. Okay, clearly you came here to stir up a little bit of trouble, and I think you did so. But you like, and we go back to these characters you play. In addition to being presentational, they're often guys who like to stir, oh, I shouldn't say like to, whose bent is to stir up trouble.
Well, I put it this way. The trouble is already there, and I'm there to correct it. I mean, I'm not there to cause trouble. The trouble is that people believe in the wrong things, or they don't believe in anything, or they believe in money, or they don't understand, for instance, when Donald Trump talks about a wall. We already have a wall. It's called the Bill of Rights. And that's why we've had for 250 years no walls. And we are more admired, and we caused the greatest mass migration of human beings in the history of civilization by having the Bill of Rights. And it's still going on. Nobody in Europe ever says, I can't wait to get to Norway. They say, I can't wait to get to America, because America offers political opportunity, capital opportunity, okay? We are the most important political revolution in history. Before us was punishment. Then we offered the world for free everything they were punished for.
We have to take a break. It's the treatment. My guest is Richard Dreyfuss. I'm going to get my visa together for Norway. We'll be back with more after this.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes. Join Jacqueline Coley as she hosts a brand new podcast, Scene on Screen. Meet the innovative people at NBC Universal as they share their journeys, inspirations, and the movies that define them. Each episode is an intimate and fun conversation about the impact of film. Scene on Screen is available now wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Listen to KCRW's music stream, Eclectic 24, for handpicked music around the clock. You can find all of KCRW's produced content on our app. Download it for free at kcrw.com/apps.
Welcome back. It's The Treatment. I guess I'm not going to nowhere after all. I'll just continue to sit across from my fascinating guest, Richard Dreyfuss. It's such a pleasure to have you here. You were talking about the kind of starter you wanted to have, which would give you control. And again, which takes you to so many of these characters that you played. You clearly, despite your denial, have some small affinity for stirring up a little bit of trouble. I want to ask you something I've always wanted to ask you. Have you ever played a character that you had to play, but a character who scared you, somebody who frightened you on the page? You looked at him and went, I don't know, but I'm going to do this anyway.
Not yet. I expect that if I played Hitler, I would feel that way.
Well, some part of me thinks that there's some of these characters you take on, and again, I know that you have your issues with Judy Kravitz, right?
No, I used to. It's an overblown thing. I really like the performance. I just was so young, I didn't know what it meant to look at me on film for an hour and a half.
Really? Is that what it was?
Yeah.
Because it's a remarkable performance. I mean, in terms of the take on a character so close to what Richler wrote in the book, that it's really a wonder to see something like that.
Do you know that in Canada, when we were making it, people would come up to me in bars and they would say, are you playing Doody? And I would say, yes. And they would say, don't move. And they gesture to their friends, come over here, I'm going to make you laugh. He's playing Doody. And people would burst into laughter because everybody knew that Doody was 6'2", skinny, kinky-haired, okay? There was a woman, a fabulous woman that I met in the last week. She says to me, may I ask you a question? I said, sure. She said, how does it feel you play Doody and you're not Doody, you don't look like Doody, and you're not him? How does it feel? And I said, pretty good until now. And we went together for 3 years.
But if you read the book, that, I mean, it's this sort of thing where you have to get past that thing because there was something with you, I think, that sort of sense of presentation, that sense of going after the world, that sense of being this guy who likes to stir up a little bit of trouble. All these things that Richler wrote about the character, and forget the physical part of it, you embodied all of that.
What did Jews do when they got to the New World? Jews had always had establishment walls they couldn't get over. They came here, and there were no establishment walls. And so they actually achieved, and they were so guilty for their achievement and the people they'd left behind. And that's a real thing. And then the Holocaust happened, so that American and Canadian Jews were paralyzed because they had gained so much by having, you know, an even chance, and their cousins end up burnt in the ovens. And so people, like a person, needs therapy. And the Jews needed therapy at that moment and didn't get it. What they got was they let a crime be committed in their name and took the reward and have been dealing with that ever since. I tried to tell my son one day that the people who are still on stage in the Middle East are all victims, and the real villains have left the stage, Winston Churchill, the oil companies like that. I said, the only way to fix this one, and if we fix it, we prevail, is one word, forgive. And not just forgive them, but forgive ourselves. because there's not an atrocity that the Arabs have ever committed that we have not committed. And we have to learn that we must forgive and start again.
It's interesting you say that, because I think so many of the characters you played have not actually forgiven themselves. I mean, there's this thing that drives them, and they don't have that kind of distance. And I was wondering if you, since Madoff is your most recent big role, if that was something, because I wonder if you feel like he would have been capable of forgiving himself. Because I think you talk about self-awareness, but there's also an enormous amount of self-delusion there, too, that he can't really countenance what it is that he is actually doing.
Well, he was a sociopath. There's one shot in the film that I don't think should be there.
Which is that?
It's the shot when Blythe leaves me and I sit there and I cry. And I don't think he cried. I don't think he thought about it. I think he was a sociopath. He had no empathy at all. He pretended to have empathy. And that's why when he went to prison and someone said to him, "What do you think of your victims?" And he turned and said, "My victims, I'm suffering now." And he's not a normal human being. He's an insane, sociopathological nut. And he did it for the most base of reasons, you know, getting his shirts done in London. And he ruined the lives of millions of people. And the problem is, so did everyone else on Wall Street, and they're not being punished.
Well, that happens so often. It's easy to find the one person, because you can blame one person instead of blaming the institution, can't you?
Well, someone said that the whole thing was blamed on Bernie Madoff and Martha Stewart.
Stewart, yeah. White people have it so hard, Richard. It's a treatment, I guess, as Richard Dreyfuss. We're talking about any number of things. But I was asking you that question, if there's ever a character that scared you, because you're talking about some of these people that you play being self-aware. And I think for Madoff, it was that awareness of presentation, you know, having the shirts made and everything custom done, again, so you can go onto the world stage and convince people that you're this character that you are not. Even though some part of you is so invested in that character, you don't really know who and what you are, or you blind yourself to the damage you cause. And I wonder if that becomes a scary prospect. It's a great role. Certainly, that's got to be a very attractive thing to do. But is there something slightly scary about playing a guy like that?
No. Because he had no exit strategy. He never thought
they get caught.
When the towers fell, he said, "This is how it ends. Everybody dies, and I get away with it." He never, ever thought that he had to stop. All right, he was crazy, but he fits into my oeuvre, my body of work, because it shows so many things. Not only about him and his family, but about the institutions of the financial industry, the SEC, the people who didn't make the calls. And I wonder what happened to shame. What happened to shame in this country? Because the SEC should be ashamed of themselves. Instead of defending little schmutzy things in front of the Congress. Some SEC woman said, "Well, actually, Congressman, we really don't know where that money went." And he said, "Are you insane?" The guy went crazy. And no one resigns under principle. No one is ashamed. The closest I've heard of shame is when Alan Greenspan said, "I have to face the idea that the ideas I've lived by my whole life are wrong." When he said that, I thought, whoa, we have to have a spiritual revolution.
We were talking about that lack of spirituality before we sat down, that thing that's missing from not only discourse, but as a tenet of this society. But I guess I asked you that question about Madoff because we were also talking about Arthur Miller, and Madoff could almost be a character out of Miller to me. I mean, he could be He could be in the part of the Crucible. I mean,
he was the father in All My Sons. If he hadn't committed suicide.
Sure, sure. But it's funny because we're talking, I just realized you basically played Cheney twice because you sort of played him in The American President.
Well, I think that of Dole.
Do you think it's more Dole than Cheney? Because that's that.
Yeah. Okay. I think Cheney's a demonic character.
I would say that the character you played in The American President was pretty demonic.
No, I think he was an American politician.
So you think he was cynical? Because I felt like he was not. And that again, we're talking about...
I think it's the difference between Donald Trump and everybody else.
Go.
Donald Trump is a person who has no common decency. It's not his policies or his politics. It is his lack of common decency that I object to. And his mean-spirited, bullying, lying, and... knowing his audience so well that he can lie three times in one speech and he can call his opponents names that you couldn't abide. And he does it because he understands us better than anybody.
You used a phrase, a word in that as you were talking about him that I think speaks to that and speaks to a lot of what politics is. And I thought about it in both in W and American President. Audience. You said he understands his audience. You didn't say his constituency.
Right.
You didn't say his voting base. You said he understands his audience. Is that what interests you in playing some of these figures who, because I feel in effect that Madoff was a political figure, because anytime there's that much commerce involved, then it's politics, whether you want to call it that or not. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And certainly we talked about the characters you played. And there, if there's understanding of audience, which again, for me, takes this conversation back to you playing these characters who are presentational, who in some way or another knowing that they're speaking
okay.
to audiences.
I'll accept that for a second.
Okay.
Let's say this. Both parties betrayed their base for 30 years. The Democrats did it. The Republicans did it. No one in the country was lifted up by their bootstraps except the extremely wealthy. And no tax idea has been put forth that is in any way fair, and the distance between the very rich and the poor is widening every day. And no one's making an attempt. And we feel finally, finally, the outrage. We got angry, but we were not told how to channel that anger. And that's what civic training is, how to channel it, how to stop it.
But if you got people like these people we're talking about who are basically playing characters, I mean, I almost feel like you're in the back room somewhere with Donald Trump and he's away from everything. He's almost like your character in The American President. He's really kind of detached from it and he can sort of spot what he's doing, what he's saying. If you've got people who are treating the voters, the voting population, as an audience instead of as people to engage in conversation with, doesn't that create a kind of cynicism in the conversation?
I would say this. Nowadays, an American politician, when he speaks in public, he knows what he's going to say. He knows what his audience is going to react to. They know what he's going to say, and they know how they're going to react. It's a ritual dance. It's not any information. It's no longer...
But for somebody like Trump, it's not a ritual dance.
Trump is not a politician. Trump has an understanding of America that politicians don't.
Yes.
And what he said was, all this anger, I'm going to grapple all this anger to me. All right? Bernie Sanders' anger and Trump's anger. It's all the same. It's an objection to the betrayal of the birthright of America.
It's almost as if you put Archie Bunker in a suit and gave him a bad hairpiece, he becomes Donald Trump.
No, I liked Archie Bunker.
You got to come back. We got to talk about this playwriting competition that you wanted to start. There's so much other stuff we didn't get any chance to get into because there's only 28 minutes of the show. I can't thank you enough for doing this, Richard. Thank you so much.
You're welcome, and thank you.
Oh, my pleasure. My guest, who has a lot to say, and I don't care what he tells you, he likes to stir up trouble, is Richard Dreyfuss. His most recent triumph, of course, is playing Bernie Madoff from the ABC miniseries. Our recording engineer here at NPR is Peter Stensel. The show is mixed by Kat Yor. It's edited by Blake Veit, who's associate producer. I have nothing left to say. It's the treatment. catch up on past episodes of The Treatment, go to kcrw.com or listen on your smartphone with KCRW's mobile apps, or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or if you listen to podcasts. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.